Hello and welcome to the Magic Musicals and Theatre Podcast. I'm Alice Arnold, and in this podcast we're going to have a look back at some of the highlights of last year. Right, for our first clip, I went backstage to visit Miranda when she was playing Miss Hannigan in the musical Annie. And before you hear this, you should probably be aware that we are old chums and that the cake that I'd given her had actually been dropped on the floor. Anyway, I'm in your dressing room.
You are in my dressing room. It's so exciting.
The Piccadilly Theatre where you are starring in Annie, the musical.
Oh, no. Why are you laughing? We're both laughing.
How?
Well, what?
How did it happen? Yes, exactly.
I suppose we're laughing more because you know me, so it's kind of funnier how it's all happened. Well, it came about a random route, but basically I was sort of thinking, you know, I would love to do something very different. I'd love to tread the boards again. Don't want to write another stand-up tour. That's very tiring and lonely. I want to be in a company, in a structure. I was thinking... and I couldn't find the right play that I wanted to do. And then I thought, should I just put feelers out? So I asked someone in musical theatre, and I said, do you think it's a ridiculous notion? Would you ever sponsor me to learn to sing and dance? Because realistically, I'm never going to go to lessons on my own. I've been trying to do that for 20 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, any excuse not to, or scared or whatever. And this theatre producer said, well, funny you should say, but I know that they're taking Annie into the West End next year, so I'll put you in touch with the producer, who then said... offered it to me.
You're a shoo-in.
And I was like, within 3 days this all happened, and I was like, oh, hang on a minute. Hang on, everyone, hang on.
But you are a massive Strictly fan.
I am a massive Strictly fan.
You like the dancing
I love dancing. I love musicals. I love singing. I've always wanted to dance and sing my whole life, and just sort of haven't, through fear mainly.
So did they send you off then for dancing and singing
lessons? So when they said, will you do it, I said, I asked them, I said, you need to see if I can pull this off, because I'm not going to do it just to be, you know, just for stunt casting. Mm. I want to do it because I can do it. And so I met the MD, and he said, which of course is musical director, I now know. Well, the MD had said, playing my piano at home and me trying to sing, he says, you've got a long way to go, and you need singing lessons to learn how to technically sing, because you never sung, but you do have an instrument. So
you have an instrument.
I have an instrument,
and it wasn't a triangle,
because I'm musical. I can sing in tune.
Yeah, and you like your carols and everything. We've done that.
We go yearly to the Albert Hall. Obviously, that's a showbiz exclusive, isn't it, for the listeners?
It is. We're still allowed to go there.
Do you do the desk scans, or is that just me and Sarah?
I can't do them anymore because they're way too high. In fact, I sing the carols now an octave down.
You go down, I do the desk scans.
I can't do that.
And Claire Balding tells us off for being too loud.
For doing anything much. Yeah, she's worried about all our reputations.
She is worried about our reputations. She will always be my head girl looking after me.
Our next guest is Jason Manford, who probably, I think, we know better as a comedian, but we discovered he does actually come from a very musical background. Now, but your family were musical.
Yes, yes. They were all performers on my mum's side, the Irish side. So my gran, Nana Ryan, Nora Ryan, she came over in the 50s with my granddad from Dublin to the Northwest, and they were like a little folk duo, and they toured the pubs and clubs of the Northwest, the Irish scene and the folk scene, and they were great. You know, she was a brilliant showwoman. She was just so engaging, and you know, just these men just were in love with her. You know, even now, funnily enough, even now, if I'm in a pub in Manchester, there'll be old Irish men, you know, and they're not coming over to speak to me because they've seen me on telly. They're coming over to speak to me about my nana, who is not no longer with us now, but. And then she had 11 children. They had 11 children.
11.
Mm. And she taught them all how to play instruments, and she taught them all to harmonise and sing. And by the sort of mid to late 70s, they were this huge show band.
Double the Von Trapps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were with the costumes and the outfits and the full show. And they'd started doing country songs and, incorporating that into their acts. I think a couple of them ended up on New Faces, mm-hmm. you know, at the time, and you know, so they were doing really, really well, and that was and that is what I remember from when I was a kid. Really, was Sunday afternoon, we would go to the Little Western Pub in Moss Side, and my and the band were on. The whole band were playing on this tiny stage. Everyone cramped onto this stage. It was packed. There was people like outside. I remember sitting under the pool table eating prawn cocktail crisps with my with my brothers, and the bass sound like coming from the other room. Because that's what I always thought I'd end up doing. I thought I'd just go down the family tradition, I suppose. Like in my family, it would have been more of a shock if it had gone, guys, I want to be an accountant.
Yes.
They'd have been, how dare you? Not under my roof.
Job?
Yes. You get on that stage.
Now, although most of my chats have been about musical theatre, we also did chat to David Baddiel, because his one-man show, which was not a musical, obviously, but he really reveals some truths about his family and his life. And it got quite deep, this interview, and he was fascinating. How old were you when your mother...
Started her affair with a golfing memorabilia.
Yes, yeah.
I'd say I first... Well, I certainly, when she started it, I was probably quite young and not aware that that's what it was. But by the time I was 13 or 14, and she was, one of the things that the show is very keen on, making it, my mother was very proud of her affair. My mum felt that having an affair was glamorous, and that the man that she was having an affair with was, in her mind, a kind of superstar, even though he was a golfing memorabilia salesman. But in my mum's imagination, and he is quite dishy, I would say, he had a beard and a pipe and everything. I was probably, by the time I was a teenager... I was not only well aware of it, I was making jokes about it. It had gone through whatever damage it might have caused and into comedy quite early on.
And did that affect your relationships in the future in terms of trusting people?
No, I don't. That's a very good question. And it's not something in 10 years of therapy, I think, ever came up. I think that it depends what you mean by trust, you see, because although I've always been monogamous in my life, I don't believe in monogamy. I think monogamy is clearly not the way we're meant to live our lives. Now, I think it is the easiest way in a relationship in which you love the other person to be, but I don't believe in it. So, for example, when people say the word cheat, I don't use the word cheat. I think whenever people talk to me, whenever the tabloids say X or Y is a love rat or a cheat, I think, no, that person is bad at monogamy, which we think everyone has to be good at, but they're just bad at monogamy. So I don't... And this might be to do with my mum, because I absolutely don't judge her. And if you come and see the show, you'll see it's a massive celebration of some level of the mad way in which she conducted this affair. I don't have judgment about that. So when you say you don't trust people, I wouldn't think of it like that.
So you didn't feel that she was betraying your father?
Well, I guess I didn't. That's very complicated, because I talk a lot about my dad in the show, and I talk about my dad's dementia, and the whole show at some level is about memory and what people remember. And you know, I talk quite a lot about my dad and the fact that as far as I can make out, despite my mother really, really broadcasting this affair, because she was very proud of it, he somehow managed not to notice it. Right. And that's kind of, and for me, all that has become comic, you see. And by the time it becomes comic, I can't see what she did as a betrayal. For me, there's always a beauty to something that's funny.
So far in this programme, we've been talking to performers. But of course, without brilliant writers, the performers have nothing to perform. So in our next chat, we hear from the writers of the new show Everybody's Talking About Jamie. And the music is written by Dan Gillespie-Sells of The Feeling. And the lyrics are by Tom McRae. And here they are telling us how it all came about.
Stories of a 16-year-old boy... at his school, has the dream of growing up and becoming a drag queen, a professional drag queen. Doesn't really know how to start going about it, but also wants to announce his dream and announce his thing by turning up at the school disco, or the school prom, as they call them nowadays, in a dress. And it's a true story. It's inspired by a documentary that we saw. Jonathan Buttle saw the documentary and thought this is a great idea for a show, and I think it could be a really wonderful musical, and was in discussions with Daniel Evans at the Crucible Theatre. And Daniel loved the idea as well. And then he had to set about finding the writers. And that's the next stage of the story, is when me and Tom were put in touch with Jonathan.
But quite by chance, Dan and I had met quite a few years before, actually on a rally. And we kind of hit it off, and I was a huge fan of Dan's music. And I had a sitcom on TV at the time that Dan liked, so we kind of had a professional love-in as well. And Dan kept saying, we should write a musical. And so we started about writing some songs, but we didn't have a clue what we were doing. And then we bumped into Michael Ball at the theatre literally, we didn't know him. We just, there he was, and he was Michael Baller. And so we said hello, and we kind of introduced ourselves. And Michael, God bless him, took an interest in us. He took us under his wing, gave us some advice, and ultimately put us in touch with Jonathan Butterill. And we had absolutely no idea that Johnny Butterill was looking for writers, was struggling to find writers. And then he heard about these two guys who just started writing musicals and thought we could be the ones. And it all fell into place beautifully and entirely beyond our control.
So Michael was brilliant when we first, you know, gave us a bit of advice, just said, start writing, start coming up with stuff. You need a bit of guidance. And that's where Jonathan Butterill came in, because mm-hmm. Jonathan's got a lot of experience, particularly working in America, New York, on musicals.
And he's a Sheffield boy, which is why we set the show in Sheffield and opened in Sheffield. So we located it kind of in his sort of childhood haunts, really, which is an area of Sheffield called Parson Cross, where the show is still set as we move into London. And then we just wanted to meet Jonathan to get some advice from a director. We had no idea that he had a secret plan to bring us onto this project.
Our next guest was probably the youngest, I think, that we spoke to during the year. She was starring in the Addams Family musical. And although she might be young, she has already had quite a career. Here is Carrie Hope Fletcher.
Then by the age of 7, you know, obviously moving on now, you're quite mature. We're now at 7,
yes.
Well into your career.
Absolutely.
You're now in Les Miserables in the West End.
At the Palace Theatre, yeah. It was Little Eponine, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was amazing. So just straight away, were you always, your parents just said, right, off you go, into a show.
It was me.
Get the kids working, come on.
I was a real madam when I was younger.
Were you?
Yeah, I was a real handful. If I wanted to do something, I was going to do something and no one could stop me. I saw, because my older brother went to Silver Young's Theatre School, and so I mm-hmm. saw him acting, and I was like, I want to do the same thing, mm-hmm. and sort of gave mum and dad no choice about the matter. And so I joined Sylvia Young's agency and, yeah, was off auditioning for roles here, left, right and centre.
And getting them, clearly.
Well, it was very easy to look cute. That's kind of all that's required of you when you're 7 years old, just sort of stand on the right point and give a nice smile to the audience. That's pretty much it.
And of course, your brother Tom is a huge star.
He is.
I mean, he's the lead vocalist from McFly mm-hmm. and McBusted. And is there sort of like lots of competition between the two?
No, there's none. I think it's the age gap between us that has kind of kept us so close. He's 7 years older than me.
Right. Oh, big enough.
Yeah. So he was always a very protective older brother, rather than. I think if we were any closer in age, it would have been sort of competitive, but. He was always very keen to sort of show me how to do things and then was very proud of me when I sort of did them and succeeded, yeah.
Yeah. Now, one of the big hits in the West End right now is Dreamgirls. And one of the stars of the show came all the way from the States to play the role of Effie. She is Marisha Wallace. Tell me how London's West End is different from Broadway.
Broadway, it's just different in the fact, I do feel like a stage is a stage, like, because I've worked on so many different stages because I've done national tours and things too, but like a stage is a stage. I do feel like the people here are hungry for the theater because they don't get shows like Dreamgirls here, and I feel like we have so many singers that sound like the singers in Dreamgirls in America, so it's not as special. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So here, it's just like, they're like, what? I've never heard a voice like this, or I've never heard people sing like this. So they're just so excited about the show, which is really cool. So I'm like, well, it is special. It's because we take it for granted because we hear people sing like that. Like, my mom can sing like that, or my grandma can sing like that. You know what I mean?
Because you talked about having a church background when you said that everybody just sort of sang.
Everybody sings
gospel
like
singers
that.
Yeah,
it's crazy because, like, your whole family can sing like that. So it's not even something special to you. But then to come here and to sing like I do, and everyone's like, what is that? You know, so it's really cool.
Yeah, so you can stand out here and be different.
Yeah, you can be different.
Rather than be just with everybody else in America.
And Broadway, I love both. It's just, you know, it's just a different, it's just, I don't know. There's a lot of community on Broadway, which I like because I guess it's been around so long. But I do feel like the West End is having a renaissance.
We're going to hear from a new star now. He was absolutely charming and sweet when he came into the studio. He came in to talk about his new album. It's Joe McKeldry.
I was always asked to do musical theatre roles pretty much from the get-go of coming out of X Factor. And I always had this, like, it was always kind of, for me, I was like, oh, can I do it? Can I not? I always felt like it was a little bit, I didn't want to just go into it because I'd done X Factor, if that makes sense. I didn't want to just turn up into a role when I wasn't ready and everybody go, well, he's only doing that because he won X Factor. You know, I would hate to be that person in that environment. I like to do a job and I like to do it properly and I like to be ready for it and prepared. So I was always like, that's not for me, that's not for me. And I always kind of avoided it in the early days because I was a little bit scared, you know, of the criticism. It's a much more disciplined way of working than kind of pop singing. You know, when you're doing your own shows, it's all fitted around you. It's all your material. It's just you being you. And that's very easy, you know, for me to stand on stage and chat to an audience and sing. I find it very easy. You know, I'm comfortable with it. It doesn't phase us. I love it. I enjoy it. And to be a character and delve into the emotions of things like that was something that I'd never done before. So when they asked me to do Joseph, I was like, this is an amazing opportunity, but can I do it? You know, are people going to enjoy us doing it? Am I going to be hated for it? I don't want to be the worst one. All of these things that I was thinking. And then I thought, do you know what it is? Just go for it. Push yourself out of your comfort zone. And it paid off, you know.
Well, it seems to have gone quite well because Mark Shenton, who's a very well-known theatre critic, basically said that it was the best sung Joseph that he has ever seen.
I mean, I'm very flattered by that. You know, to have somebody like him say that is incredible.
I also chatted to our very own Ruthie Henschel. Let's go back to the very beginning and then we'll bring you up to the present day as we go through. So did you always know that this was your calling?
Yes. I honestly don't remember wanting to do anything else. And it was from the moment that I found dancing, which was about 10 years old, and it was like somebody switched the light on, you know, at that aha moment that you have where you go, oh, I love this. And it was ballet, of all things. You know, for quite a while there, I was very... I thought that was where my career was going to go. And then somebody gave me a real sort of, you know, awakening and said, you're not good enough, darling.
Oh, really? Yeah. Reality check.
Yeah,
yes.
Big reality check. Because, you know, I wasn't, you know, my technique was nowhere near for a dancer. And I think... You know, the discipline that you need to stay in that business for as short a time as they get to stay in it.
And the physical punishment.
It's insane.
Extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. So, anyway, you did go to... You went to theatre school after 16.
Did, yes, Lane Theatre Arts.
Yeah. And then you learnt the whole lot.
Yes. And I think that was when it was like, I felt like sort of Victor Meldrew. I do believe it, I do believe it. As all these sort of new wonderful things came at me. And I thought, oh, and I only thought that was ballet. So it was gorgeous.
And what was your first sort of big break? I mean, you were in choruses, presumably, to start with. And then
I was in Cats. I was in the original cast of Miss Saigon, you know, playing Bar Girl number 3. And and it was actually in Miss Saigon that I thought, If I'm going to do this business, I want to be at the front, because I understudied Ellen and I went on for it. And Alain Bublé and Claude Michel Schoenberg were in that night. And Claude Michel often reminds me of the fact that I walked past him after the bow, Ellen's bow, my first time on. And I said, he said, you came past me and you said, Claude, I have been at the front. I am never going back. and he said, and you did not. And that was where I decided that I wasn't going to understudy anymore. I wasn't going to take chorus jobs. I would only do them if it was the lead.
Right.
And somehow or other that worked. I don't know how it did, but it did. I think, you know what? I honestly think half of the battle is knowing what you want.
As I said at the beginning of the show, some of my guests came into the studio, but others, they let me go into their dressing room. And it's always rather fun to be backstage and sort of soak up some of the atmosphere before the show starts. Tracy Ann Oberman was in Stepping Out when I went to see her, but she was actually just about to finish in Stepping Out and to go to Chichester to star in her first ever musical, Fiddler on the Roof. She's so talented. I love Tracy Ann Oberman. We had a lovely chat.
Now, I did read that your parents weren't all that happy when you decided to be an actress because they wanted to be a lawyer.
Absolutely. Well, anything, I think, but an actress.
Right,
because
yeah.
It's such an insecure profession. It was like saying that you wanted to be an astronaut. You know, it's like we'd never met one and how did one become one?
So there was nothing in your family? No drama
actually,
no, in your
weirdly,
family?
Actually, weirdly, on my dad's side, there is... Claudia Winkleman is my cousin.
Okay.
And her side of the family, that was on my dad's side. Her side of the family were all artists and writers, and so. But from my mum and dad's sort of perspective, no, there wasn't any actors, and who made a living from acting? And what was, you know, how could you live?
Yeah.
I think my dad's words were, "You're going to end up living in a bedsit for the rest of your life with a cat."
Yeah.
So every day I'm not living with just a cat in a bedsit, I feel I'm winning.
Did they make you do a typing course or something as a backup?
No, I had to do a degree. No, did you?
I did a degree and a typing course.
Yeah. But luckily, the day after I left drama school, I got a job. I got an advert. I got a voiceover, first of all.
Oh, wow.
Who knew what that was? I went up for an advert the day after I left, and I got this voiceover for After Eights with Simon Goodell. After Eight, it is the after dinnerment after all. And that sort of kept me in shillings for
I
got another advert, a visual advert, so that was good. And then the day after that, I got a job with the RSC.
Then came EastEnders.
Well, I'd done a lot of telly, actually, before EastEnders, a lot of telly. And then I did this play at the National with Ken Branagh called Edmund by Mamet. Everyone came to see it in the entire world. Mamet, De Niro, all these Americans. It was sold out. It was absolutely a smash hit. I mean, it was just brilliant, great cast. And on the back of that, suddenly, I did really well in that, and I was getting lots of meetings. And then I got asked to come into EastEnders, and I was the only name that I hadn't heard of on that list. And within 9 days, I was cast as Dirty Den's wife and hit the ground running and had signed this long 3-year contract, thinking, oh, my goodness, oh, my goodness. And 4 months after that, I, having worked in the industry for 11, 12 years solidly, I was up for Best Newcomer at the National Television Awards.
This was another treat for me. Sheridan Smith came into the studio. Now, you're so versatile. You do so many... We're going to do Country and Western for your next album, but you do musical theatre and you do big showstoppers and you do wonderful ballads. And how... Where next? I mean, do you? Is that difficult to go, well... Because you can't put you in a niche because you're a comedian and you're an actress and you're a singer and you do everything.
Oh,
does that make
thank
it difficult
you.
To choose what project to do next?
I just feel so grateful that it's... I can't quite believe that people give me all these different opportunities, you know, so I'm forever grateful. And I kind of just think, well, see what comes along next, you know. And often when I'm reading scripts, you know, I want to do something that's totally different to something I've done before. So it keeps pushing you a little bit, you know, and I just love losing myself in characters. So acting is kind of that's my real passion. And so as long as I keep acting, and like I said, you know, I am a workaholic, so I'm sure I'm kind of working until 2019 now. I'm booked up. So.
Are you? For the whole of next year?
Yeah.
Not one of those resting actors waiting for the phone to ring. Not you.
Well, no, not yet. No. Touch wood, you never know. I'm just taking... That's why I feel very lucky. I'll take it while it's there, you know.
Well, I hope you enjoyed a look back at some of the best bits from last year's podcast. I'm Alice Arnold, and I'm delighted to tell you that the new series begins next week with Matthew Bourne.